Welcome to The Lowdown, KMXT's new daily show dedicated to giving you the up-to-date information we have available on COVID-19 outbreak and how it's impacting life on Kodiak Island. The Lowdown will focus on the facts as provided to us by local and state officials. During the show, we give you access to local officials and experts on COVID-19 and community actions related to it. If you have questions for our guests, please email them to lowdown@kmxt.org or call KMXT at 486-3181. You can find a list of upcoming guests on our Facebook page or on our website, kmxt.org. Audio from each day's program will be posted on the website. To the sad, sad truth, the dirty lowdown.
Thanks for tuning in this morning for another edition of The Lowdown. Today we're going to be tackling two things. First, we've got on the phone Sam Dapkovich from DOT on a press release issued last evening in regard to newest protocols for traveling aboard the Marine Highway System, specifically in relation to the Kennecott and the Tustamina today we're going to focus on. Then we're going to have an in-person discussion with local economic development group, Amy Williams from Discover Kodiak and John Whidden from the Kodiak Economic Development Corporation, about what's happening locally in regard to grant-making progress and what they're seeing in regard to the business community's continuing response to the pandemic, and maybe a little bit about hiking challenges, too. So thank you all for being here this morning. Appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, guys. The Tustamina and the Kennecott are vital to Kodiak's community, and people have been scrambling around since Sunday when the first release was issued in regard to what was going to be required of them to safely travel on the Tustamina. And the testing requirements sort of became an antenna raiser for a lot of people in the community. And then this release came out last night. So, Sam, can you explain to people who are traveling to and from Kodiak, from Homer, from Whittier, what will be required of them now?
Okay, so the routes out of Kodiak and Kodiak North and Whittier or Homer South to Kodiak, those routes do not require a COVID-19 test or a sworn statement of quarantine. We consider those to be shorter duration routes. So you're good there. You can travel like regular intrastate travel from community to community. The longer duration routes, like from Kodiak heading out the chain or coming back from out the chain to Kodiak, those are going to require either a test or a sworn statement signed that says you have met quarantine standards for the last 14 days preceding your voyage. There's also those same rules apply for people who are heading across Gulf, like from Whittier to Southeast. But that's what's in place, you know, for the Kodiak area.
So for the Kodiak area, the protocols that were originally released on the 21st, passengers mm-hmm. over the age of 2 have to have a negative test within 72 hours. Mm-hmm. That's no longer appropriate.
That doesn't apply when Health and Social Services worked with us on this originally. Their focus was on interstate travel, not intrastate travel, and we decided to clarify that it's the longer duration routes and the interstate travel are going to be where the testing is applied. The shorter duration routes, it does not apply.
So since we've seen a trend throughout the state of most of the new cases popping up from interstate travel, it seems to be more like what's required of you at the airport that is now required of you at the ferry.
It's very similar, other than the fact that the longer duration routes, when people are on a ferry potentially multiple nights, there's a lot more time where close contact could take place, and so those require either that signed statement of quarantine or a test showing that you're negative before boarding the vessel. And people who can't meet either of those standards will be denied boarding.
Okay. The passenger screening form, is that something that's still going to be presented to people before they get on board the vessels?
Yep, that's going to take place for all passengers. They ask those five questions, mainly dealing with your current health condition. You know, if you're fevering, if you have a cough, chills, aches, pains, and so on, or if you've had close contact with someone who had a positive test, or if you have been in a different area or a country with widespread COVID-19 transmission.
So you can't get on the boat.
If you answer yes to any of those questions, those five questions on the screening form, you can't get on the boat. And if you're displaying signs of, you know, flu-like symptoms, the crew are expected to alert the captain, and he would make the call of whether or not you get on the boat.
Hmm. So enforcement is right there at the gate. Then what happens on the ship?
So on the ship, if something does take place, they have a COVID-19 mitigation plan in place. I'd have to pull it up to tell you the exact details, but it has to do with immediately isolating the person who displays symptoms. And of course, there's other things involved, but I'd have to get into that report to explain it all. But they do have a very detailed mitigation plan for onboard ship.
Okay. So masks are going to be required, social distance is required. It's kind of use common sense if you're on the boat.
Correct.
If something develops on the boat, I notice in the earlier, actually it was in the one from last night, it says that if people don't use common sense, you put other people on the boat at risk, and that there's a potential for a 14-day quarantine without
14 days, yeah.
Without a port call. So it's kind of important that we all act together to keep this thing safe.
Yeah, this is serious business. We saw that with the Testamina, and we want people and passengers and crew need to act responsibly so that we can keep this service going. You know, when you take a vessel offline, there's a cascading effect, and it trickles down to everybody. So,
okay. So, for I got a specific question I'll get to in a second. For people here who have relatives or want to come from Bellingham here, what's the difference in what you have to go through before you can get here?
So for Bellingham, outbound Bellingham travel, like if you're coming from Bellingham up into Alaska, you have to have a COVID-19 test administered within 72 hours of your day of departure, and you have to show up with a negative result at that Bellingham terminal. We do accept electronic results, so if you get the test if you're driving through, you know, California, Oregon, Washington, if you get the test somewhere along the way and they email you your result, you're allowed to display that emailed result to board the ship.
Isn't some of the problem that people have been having, though, the turnaround time with testing?
Yeah, so we have linked to a map that shows all, you know, most of the testing locations in the lower 48. And there's contact info on there. You can call those places and see what your turnaround time looks like. I've been in touch with passengers who are currently waiting in Bellingham to come north, and they've been able to get testing at places where the turnaround time is 48 hours. So it is doable, but it takes a little bit of research on the passenger's end to get the right place.
So there are resources on your website, or at the DHSS website, right, for places to go and suggestions for how to get testing if you're coming up here.
Yeah. The best one that I've seen is there's a map, an ArcGIS type map, and it allows you to see the whole lower 48 and Alaska, and it shows you testing locations. And when you click on one, it pops up and tells you the contact info and the location. So,
okay, I got specific questions from listeners. If I go to Sand Point, do I need a test when coming back to Kodiak from Sand Point 4 days later?
Technically, yes, because any ship that comes from out the chain direction to Kodiak, you would be required to test if you're either ending in Kodiak or going through Kodiak.
So how are the resources out the chain for testing?
I've looked at the can we go back to that question? So
yeah.
So they go to Sandpoint and
yeah.
they're coming back in 4 days. We allow for a test within 5 days, so they could technically, I think, get a test in Kodiak. That's an interesting one, though. We might have to talk that through with AMHS management and see, you know, if an exception could be made for that. We are, you know, considering unique situations on a case-by-case basis.
So if somebody had needed help like that, where would they go to get permission?
They could contact me. I'm willing to give my phone number out if that's okay with you.
You bet.
It's 907-465-4503, and I can take the details and pass it on to the decision makers.
Okay.
See what we can do.
Thanks. The second question I have is, what's the protocol for crew? Is it the same protocol as for passengers?
It's a little bit more strict for crew. They're going to be getting tested regularly, and they're not, you know, just like passengers, when you go port to port, they're not allowed to go to shore. The only way that they would go to shore would be for marine highway business. And their social distancing standards are going to be very strict. We found out that was important with that Testamina issue, and mask wearing is going to be required. So it's going to be strict for all parties involved.
Have they changed, like, crew communally eating together practices and those kind of things?
I'm not sure. I'd have to check on that for you. I'm sorry.
Okay. How are bookings now? Are you seeing a return to, I mean, you're at a third capacity still, right?
Well, so I couldn't speak to the specific numbers, but I have been told that because of the fact that we're ramping service back up again, there's some pent-up demand. And so I believe ships are pretty full. Out of Bellingham, we're definitely full on our first run north. And I think the car decks are pretty full as well. So.
Okay. So for folks that still have questions, what resources would you direct them to get further information if they have more questions?
Well, on the ferryalaska.com website, we have a COVID-19 information page. The website has a lot of good resources, including the latest press release, if people want to dig into the details there. Our reservations and terminal staff are super knowledgeable, and they try to get, you know, accurate information to the customers as best they can, and they have a great management team, you know, getting all those details down to them. So call a terminal or call the 800 number. I can tell you what that is. It's 1-800-642-0066, and someone should be able to help you.
Hey, are masks going to be provided by the Marine Highway System, or is it bring your own if you forget it?
It's bring your own. We will have a limited number of masks available, but we do expect that passengers will bring their own.
Okay. Hey, thanks for talking with us again. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, good luck in what you're doing.
All right, you too.
Okay, let's get down to the real guests today. Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to see your smiling faces this morning. Big news last week. You guys have been busy little beavers, so let's talk a little bit about what you've been doing and how successful you've been.
I'll let Amy go first.
In regards to the economic development.
Sure. Yeah, I knew what you were talking about. So this week has been a great week because we have accepted all of the recipient agreements. The awardees have been dropping off their information back to us, and the city has been giving us checks. So the actual money flowing out to the community started happening yesterday officially, and we are about, well, we're over halfway. So working with the city, the finance department has been absolutely incredible, accommodating our extra needs from them. They are working way out of their normal job descriptions to help this program go, and we are truly appreciative of that. And the community members have responded just tremendously, getting their paperwork to us and showing their gratitude to the city of Kodiak for making this happen. So unlike when we were here maybe a couple weeks ago and we were like, oh, this is the worst, because we're hearing the stories and hearing about the true condition of Kodiak's economy and our small business sector, now we're seeing hope again. And that is, has been an incredible shift as we watch the program roll out.
You know, it's been interesting to, it's been interesting just over the last probably week or so. I've made some phone calls to other communities, Sitka and Kenai and a few others, and been on some conference calls and web Zoom video type things. And it turns out the process we used is a model that other communities are using. And it wasn't that, but you know, we were brilliant. We just figured it out as we went along. But what I've found is our process is really, really streamlined. And a lot of communities are still trying to figure out how to distribute and where to distribute funds. So I think for the Kodiak community, we've been able to start from basically 0 to 60 in a very short period of time and get money into people's hands. People have already got checks within a, within less than a month. And which is really fortunate, because the need is so there's such a strong need for these funds. And as Amy mentioned, so many of the people actually did get checks. I mean, I've never seen a response like this to any kind of a municipal government program. It's been really, really favorable.
Well, when we first started talking about this, when it was in its infancy, you know, there was, you didn't have a whole lot of applications right away. In the first couple of days, you had 70 or something like that. And then I'm assuming with the amount of money that you distributed, you must have got a raft of applications in before the deadline.
We had 242, but actually 238 unique users, because some people emailed and mailed. So we had doubles that we found out later. So,
did you get more money if you did that?
No. Well, no, that's it. That's why it takes a village to review. Yes.
Nice try.
Yeah. No, but people just wanted to be doubly sure that their information got to us, and it did, sometimes twice. And so 238 unique applicants, and that was a great response. We had no idea what that response was going to look like. And so it was, we found out, I personally found out there were nonprofits and other businesses operating in Kodiak that I had never even heard of. So there are a lot of folks doing great work, especially in the nonprofit world, that I didn't know was happening. So it was neat to learn about them and try to get them money so that they could continue their great work.
So, again, for those who were not involved in the process and don't know and didn't listen to the first program we did, how much money did you actually wind up distributing here?
We were able to get $2.4 million from the city. So out of the 11.9 that they had altogether, the city gave us 2.4 on this go-around. They also have set aside another $600,000 for the next round. And so right now we have a total committed from the city of $3 million, and we are certainly working hard from the city to actually get them to consider giving us more money. And also, Amy and I have been in front of the borough assembly on two occasions. We'll go back again next month to ask for money from the borough, from a portion of their CARES Act funds, because you know, the as much as it was, I think, really positive to get money into people's hands immediately, the need for additional funds for businesses who were basically restarting their businesses after being 2 months without funds and still had bills to pay, you know, they're going to need additional support to get through the summer. And then towards the end of the year, when the third round of the CARES Act funds are distributed, we fully expect that there'll be some businesses who will need still additional support, so maybe a third round, to get them through the winter, which is typically a slow time.
So the total ask amount? Do you have any idea? I mean, of the 238 applications, was everybody asking for $25,000?
Well, some people asked for a lot more than that, not understanding that the grant cap was at $25,000. So I think if we looked at the original numbers, we were around $6 million.
I tallied it up, and it was $5.9 million that people asked for. But some people asked for $300,000 instead of $25,000.
Yes. So it balanced out. Some people only asked for $3,500 or $2,500. Like that was their need, and they asked for what they needed. So, but a lot of people asked for more than that. So it was a wide variety of answers for sure.
You know, one of the interesting things I found in going through these, and actually I was on a conference call with the 4-Acre Group the other day, is that nonprofits, and we had 22 nonprofits, I think, apply. Nonprofits, surprisingly, or maybe not surprisingly if you're part of one, were far better prepared to respond to this because they're, I think, better organized than maybe some of the smaller businesses. That, you know, they certainly know how to work the grant process or like in the PPP to get the payroll protection plan. I think they're more familiar with that. Whereas the small businesses, I think, were particularly disadvantaged because that's not their realm. They don't operate in that grant funding realm. And so there were so many that just didn't know or failed to achieve or receive PPP money. So the small businesses didn't do well. The grant, the nonprofits, I think, were much better capable of coping with it.
It's a normal part of business, but in that business, but I will tell you, this application process was probably one of the easiest processes I've ever seen. And you guys were always out there too, providing support to people that needed help. So I think people shouldn't be daunted by the process, knowing that the next time you roll this out.
No, we're fully willing and want to help people fill out that form. Our goal is to get the money into the hands of the folks who need it the most. So if you are overwhelmed, I mean, we had people bring in their entire tax record files from the last 5 years. We had people with binders of, and then one guy came in with a bag of receipts and was like, help. So we just sit down and work through what they need to document what their previous year's business looked like compared to 2020 and draw lines that were COVID-19 related and get their application filled out. And I mean, we had colored pencil applications. We had fully typed applications. We had, you know, just a variety. We're meeting you where you're at for this program. So as long as there is a demonstrated need that can be related to COVID-19, the review board tried to do whatever we could for anyone that was eligible to get money to them. So this, like John said, there were a wide variety of people who are familiar with this process and those who are not. But overall, there were a lot of yeses. So that was a really great thing.
Yeah, and we took some lessons learned from people that applied for the PPP and the EIDL who'd applied and never heard back. And we really took sort of a, I think, a, now in hindsight, we took this, I think, a QC quality control approach to this. So we knew that as soon as somebody submitted an application that we wanted to let them know we'd received it. Huh. And when they'd return the application, that we'd got their completed application. So there was, I mean, Amy did all the work, so I give all the credit for this, but we wanted to make sure people had that personal touch so they didn't feel abandoned by a much bigger entity. And we really wanted to personalize that to the extent that, you know, we've been out to specific individual businesses to literally help them fill out the forms and encourage them to complete the forms so we can actually get money to them.
So you did get to kind of discover Kodiak, huh?
Yaha, nice. Yes, we absolutely did discover Kodiak, which is amazing.
And so what parts of Kodiak? I mean, how broadly did this...
All parts.
Yeah.
So we use the church network. You know, we got into different sectors of the market. We were worried about language barriers and people finding out. So we went to some of those businesses directly. John did a really good job with that, with getting applications and grant agreements out to businesses. Because we didn't want a language barrier to block people getting money. And so now we're in the follow-up phase. I have, out of the 238 applications and everything in, we have less than 20 that haven't gotten their stuff to us yet. You know who you are. Get it in. so we... they're laughing at me over here.
Well, full disclosure, you know. Yes, we were recipients. Thank you very much. And yes, the paperwork's sitting right in front of me.
Yeah, so we're reaching out, you know, today and tomorrow, getting the rest of those folks to get their paperwork in. And like I said, the city has been doing a great job with getting us the checks. So those will go out. Like, I anticipate all the checks that we have, you know, being sent out early next week. So great turnaround. And on a completely different note, I want to jump back to the ferry thing real quick. And I know that's out of order, but Camilla and Amanda down at the ferry terminal have been doing such a phenomenal job calling people, rebooking people, and keeping people updated that if we don't acknowledge that as a community, we're wrong. They are a tremendous resource. So I know they were listening at the beginning of this, and they might not hear this part because they have to hear me all the time. But thank you to them, because they have been doing phenomenal things for our community.
No, they really have. It was really nice to see the post out there last night. It got us on the horn right away, and we were able to hook up with Sam. And when she came in a couple weeks ago, it was right after this ferry got quarantined. So it was a let's hope they have better days ahead of them.
Yes, I think that's just, you know, one of the examples of the ripple effect of COVID-19 that we're not, you know, always thinking about. So I think as this ferry situation plays out and how the tourism or lack of tourism plays out, we're going to really see there's going to be a long-lasting effect, and it's going to take us a while to recover from. So,
well, you know, what you said earlier about not knowing that there were some nonprofits in town and that you're making personal contact with businesses, what kind of PR did you do for this that you found was successful? I mean, how do you reach people who don't normally maybe read the newspaper or follow social media or listen to KMXT? How do you mean that?
I was a little bit obnoxious. I was in drive-through lines. I got out of my car and went and knocked on people's windows who I knew were business owners, and I hadn't gotten a grant application from them yet. So, and then because of my day job, I was very concerned about reaching, I knew I could reach my membership, but I was very concerned about reaching tourism-based businesses that weren't my members. So I spent one night just Googling every tourism-based business in all of the villages and then leaving my contact information in where I would be making a reservation and then a link to the grant. And then, you know, call me with questions kind of thing, just to try to get out and reach people that wouldn't normally hear about it. And especially in the villages. And we had just over $400,000 of the grant money go out to the villages. So, like, I think that was a successful maneuver. So I'm really happy about that.
And we reached out, too, to, like Amy mentioned, to the church ministry network. So rather than have to contact each pastor or priest or whoever it might be, we went to the organizations. We went to PhilAm. So that I think that gave us broader dissemination. And we also literally reached out. I stopped by probably a dozen businesses and said, hey, are you going to fill this out? Please consider filling this out. Some I had to talk them into it. Some said, oh, I just don't need it. And so it was kind of an interesting response. But I hope you get to, in a second, I want to talk about the next round of grants, because I think we're going to do it differently. We haven't decided how to do that, but I anticipate the money will be available mid to late July, depending on the release of the next round of funds. But I'm thinking that we, for people who've already applied that still feel like they're eligible because they haven't met all the needs, haven't all been met, I'm thinking we won't have them fill out a full, complete application, send in all those financials again. But somebody who's a new applicant will have to go through the process. I would anticipate we'll have like an abbreviated application saying, I've already applied, I still need funds, some short documentation, so we can streamline the process for the second round of grants for people who've already applied. You know, new applicants will have to go through the whole thing, just like the original applicants. But when we're all done and Amy is done handing out all this money, we're going to sit down and sort of do a debrief and just see, okay, what worked, what didn't work, what was effective, you know, how can we improve the process and streamline it even further. And one of the things that we've already talked about is that, and Amy mentioned that the city finance department, Victoria Ellis in particular, has just been absolutely phenomenal. I mean, she worked late, I think Friday night, getting checks done after hours to get these checks out in batches. But what we think we'll probably do next time is take that check writing in-house, and we're probably going to have a bookkeeping type person that, so we don't put the additional burden on the city, and we can actually streamline the process instead of having to do these check requests and all that kind of stuff. We can take it in-house, so it'll actually speed things up. And this time we had the grant, actual grant application, and the funds request, rather, was a separate document, and the W-9 was a separate document. We'll include those as part of the packet. So when you fill out your grant application, you also at the same time sign that funds request. So we don't have to email you after you get notified of requests, so we can streamline. So we found some things that maybe took a little bit extra work, or a lot of extra work, actually, and we're going to streamline those to make it even more efficient next time.
Did you have to say no to anybody?
Yes. And that what was, I think, when we actually, the very beginning, we set out and we checked with numerous groups, Alaska Municipal League, 4-Acre, other communities, to see what they had determined as eligibility criteria. I mean, some of them were fundamental. You know, you had to be in business before 1 March 2020, which was when this COVID started. And that was the, I think that was the start date that virtually everybody used, was prior to 1 March. In fact, it was the federal requirement prior to 1 March 2020. So you had to have been in business before then. There were some people whose business licenses, I said, like June 6th or something. So that was, you know, that was an easy one. There were some people that simply didn't have business licenses. So we, one of the requirements, you had to have a business license. You know, you had to have financials so that we could back up the demonstrated need. And there were some that didn't have them. And, the, and then some people who submitted packets, well, there was really no clear nexus to any economic impact to COVID, or basically no impact at all. So I think those were probably the ones that, you know, that we denied.
Yeah, those there were some hard decisions that we had to make regarding that. And there are people who actually have been in business for a long time but just didn't have an active business license. And so those are, for those cases, we have contacted most of those folks and told them, hey, you could still be eligible for round two, but we need proof that you're in business. You, when you turn in a business license that is dated the same day as your application, that doesn't work for us. And so there are extenuating circumstances, and we do allow for some people to explain their situation, and then they would move on to being eligible in round two. So there are some folks who did apply in round one that would still be eligible for round two, and then there are folks that just aren't going to be, because, you know, if you started a business in May, that, you know, that just doesn't qualify for what we're doing right now.
Right, and it won't qualify. Excuse me, but it is a continuing problem with the business economy.
It is, and I think it are, when we look at round two and round three, those are things that we will consider depending on our funding levels. You know, if we get a lot of funding all of a sudden and we're able to expand those, you know, the cap of 25,000 or that kind of stuff, then we'll look at that. But until those decisions are made by the city and the borough, that's something that the Economic Development Corporation can't really make judgment on until we know what we're actually dealing with.
Yeah.
And we are going to hold back, at least we've talked about holding back a small portion of those funds as seed funding to create a more permanent economic development corporation, so that we can, because we know the need will exist beyond this year, that the need to, for support, for business support, for business growth and development will go way beyond this year. And this is in addition to anything the Chamber or Discover Kodiak do in their specific areas. So we are going to use some funding to look at how do we create a longer term organization that will continue to meet the needs of businesses and nonprofits.
Well, talk a little bit about the structure when you initially decided to form the corporation. I had heard you say that it was formed because you needed to have a pass-through organization to be able to distribute the funding.
Right.
But structurally, how are you set up? Do you have paid staff? Are you anticipating you're going to have paid staff? Are you using Amy and Sarah's office as support for what you're doing?
For this go around, I mean, it was all volunteer work. So as Amy mentioned, you know, all of us put in hours and hours and hours on this, and this is just volunteer work. And so our administrative overhead was virtually nothing. We did, you know, because Amy used her staff, you know, we sent a small amount of money, I mean, less than the actual lowest grant award. We sent a couple thousand dollars to Discover Kodiak to pay for the electricity, the copy paper, the postage, and all the other things that they're doing. So in terms of grant administration, a $2.4 million grant cost roughly about $2,000 to administer, which is unheard of.
Well, you got a lot of in-kind is what you're saying, though.
Right. And so we know it's not realistic to expect everybody to work for free forever and ever and ever. But You know, for the for the rest of this grant awards, the second and third round, I don't anticipate having paid employees because we're all volunteers and everybody else has a day job for the most part. But long term, Kodiak Economic Development Corporation will have to have paid staff, and that's why we're looking at maybe holding just a small portion back to see. And we haven't even figured out how we're going to structure that yet. But we know that we're going to have somebody in a paid position to do that.
Well, this has been a kind of a long-term goal for the borough and the city for a long time to get something like this going.
Right, and we've had a couple of false starts, and we try to get together a group, and you know, we've learned some lessons from that, and we're actually going to start looking at other organizations. I talked to Sitka's Economic Development Corporation yesterday. We're talking to Kenai. There's some models that exist that we might want to consider how we put this together, and it absolutely has to include the chamber, and has to include Discover Kodiak as part of this component, and how do we blend them all together that makes sense for this community, and we'll tailor that those needs to meet the community.
So are those think tank discussions with, you know, I mean, where does it go from here? From once you internally decide what you think your long-term plan is going to be, how do you finalize it and get community engagement in what you're trying to do?
Well, that's a good question. You know, we had the Economic Task Force that was originally the initial group that got together to talk about economic needs, and then that evolved into the Economic Development Corporation. So we have a core group of stakeholders from different businesses and organizations in the community. So while we haven't really formally talked about this, I would envision that we'll bring those people back together and say, okay, how do we evolve Kodiak Economic Development Corporation into a longer-term organization? And it was, so we certainly want to get input from business leaders, community leaders, from tribal organizations, native organizations. How do we do this to make sense so that we can get the best result for Kodiak? So that's probably a broad answer, but we haven't narrowed it down. But we just know the need exists. I mean, this is a perfect time, you know, given where we are in sort of time as a community, is a perfect time to look at how can we do things better.
Talk to me about your emotional response and your response to the process. I can only imagine going through these applications of, you know, hearing some pretty dire stories, right?
Yes. So when people dropped off applications, the ones that came in through the Discover Kodiak office, it wasn't just like a drop and run. A lot of people stopped and told their story why they were there. And so the emotional response was definitely there. We were a little bit prepared for that because we had already reached out to most of our membership in the tourism industry and just, you know, the uncertainty that surrounds what the rest of the summer looks like and if people are actually going to make it to the island. It was very emotional, but I'm a very emotional person, so it's going to affect me maybe more than some other folks. But I thought that I was over it until the review process came. And when you start really understanding, and there are like four people in the community who probably have an extremely good understanding of what situation our business community is really in, it's hard not to be affected. I went and spent more money. A lot of money in our small businesses, just because we know what's happening. And so that watching that evolve as we found out the need, and then being able to actually bring checks to some of the, like, I personally delivered a few checks in the last few days to businesses and members in my membership that I knew were going to fail if they didn't get this money. It made it all worth it. In those few checks, it was incredible to see their response.
And you know, most people don't want to reveal their financial situation or their personal struggles. I mean, people don't normally do that. And one of our commitments was that we would keep all this information confidential, which is the reason we did this pass-through organization. So if those financial records or personal details had been part of the city process, then they would have been subject to records request, and so anybody could have filed that and got a look at KMXT or, you know, Business X or wherever it would be. And we just knew that would be a deterrent that people wouldn't get. So because we have a separate corporation, you know, we got to basically protect that information. Now, having said that, you know, we got to see it all too. And there was some, as Amy mentioned, there were some details that it gave us a glimpse into people's financial lives and business lives that, you know, it's just a glimpse that was really heart-wrenching in many cases. And in terms of our overall economy, where do we stand? I think that we are fragile right now. We haven't got past that fragility yet. I think these funds we've injected, probably more than anything else, have injected hope for people. They know that people care. I think that was mentioned by one of the, in an article on the Daily Mirror, that somebody said, gosh, I'm just glad people know that we have a problem. They actually recognize it. And so we certainly did that. So beyond the hope, I think the next round will be, okay, now we've established hope. Now we've maybe changed momentum from being flat, you know, just out of business for 2.5 months and gradually reopening to, okay, now I got some finances and now I can restart my business. The next round will be, okay, now I can get through the summer, and the next round will be good. I can get through the winter. So hopefully next year we can go on. So we're trying to create momentum is really what we're doing here.
Were you able to reach the goal? I know that there was a time constraint on you to try and spend out all the money that was available so you'd be eligible for the next round of funding. Where have you been able to do that?
Well, it was the city's, actually the city's, there wasn't a deadline, as it turned out. We thought it had to be spent by June, but that's not the case. But the city does have to spend the first round, which is $5.3 million, in order to qualify. They have to spend 80% of that to qualify for the next round. So I think we're there. I mean, we took 2.4, so basically half the way there, and I'm pretty sure the city's going to be able to spend the next million and a half or so to get to that 80% without any trouble.
So you didn't have any problem spending what you got?
No, absolutely not.
No. That's why we need more money.
We could have spent a lot more, absolutely. Yeah.
So how do you make the decisions, though, when you know that, you know, when you're scoring these applications, was it a difficult process for you to make the decisions about who was going to get what?
Yes and no. That's a complicated question. There are some businesses that the need was so overwhelming that we were like maxed, like, here's your 25,000, here's your 25,000. And there were some who I am very appreciative of the people who were just extremely honest. And they, you know, some businesses just came in and they were like, I need $4,221.18 to cover my expenses. And those were also very easy to fund because they were so detailed and so well laid out that there was no question that they would be fully funded for what they asked for. The ones that were harder were people who own multiple businesses and just basically drawing the line, like, did COVID-19 really cause this? Or were there problems before? Or would have your outcome been any different if there wasn't COVID-19 in the picture? And those are really hard because mm-hmm. when someone, there was no business that went through that none of the review committee was familiar with. So I think one of the strengths of our program is because we do know the owners and it's very personal and we want to help as many people as we can. So that's a long-winded, complicated answer. It was hard, but I think the different personalities on the review committee balanced out the decision-making, where some people were like fully fund, another person would be like, oh, I had them written down for $2,500. And then that caused a great discussion, and we found a happy middle ground. And I think when we ended up at the end, John, we were like within $25,000 of the $2.4 million. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't have to adjust a lot. We actually got to go in and bump people up to get the rest of that $25,000. We didn't have to take any away. So
I think we had $11 left and we gave that to somebody.
Yeah, it was. It turned out
so if your check is for $5,011, yeah, you know that's that
on
you.
That person that has a one on the end of that check, that's the one.
Yeah.
You know, Amy said it is absolutely right. I think it was fairly, some of the applications were really clear on who deserved and who didn't deserve. And then there's sort of those gray areas with maybe multiple businesses. But I think the key was having financial information, you know, to determine the actual need. And some of the communities, Kenai, for example, I was on a call the other day, Kenai is not even asking for anything. They're just going to cut checks to applicants, you know, but like $5,000 checks or something. And we thought that when we looked at this at the beginning is that some people won't need the full amount. Some people definitely need the full amount. So we thought the competitive idea, and it was only really competitive is that you had to meet the criteria. Beyond that, out of the 238, we awarded 204 grants. So the 34 that didn't get it really didn't have the documentation or no demonstrated need or no demonstrated impact. So it was competitive to a point, but I think that the competitive concept allowed us to give that spread of awards from 2,500 up to 25,000. And there was not everybody got 25,000. And Amy said there were some businesses that I was just astonished that asked, I remember one asked for $3,481 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it's like, why don't you ask for more? Because I know you need more.
Yeah. Normally, in this kind of a process, if you're in a grant funding process, there's a press release that comes out and says, here's the we've just made grant awards into the community, and here's the names of the people who received funding from.
No, well, you're not going to see that from us.
Well, that's,
you might see
I have
it.
A question from
okay.
a listener, you know, and
sure.
and being in the reporting business, you know, that was the question that the reporters first had. Is
sure,
yeah, but you guys have an answer for that.
I do, and the answer is no. it's not that clear cut, but one of the things, like, there are some people who did not apply just because they didn't want the four reviewers to know what their finances were. And so part of the reason that the Economic Development Corporation was formed in the first place was to protect that. And that's a promise we made to the applicants. So are we going to tell people who applied and who got grants? No.
So maybe expand on that a little bit is that, again, one of the reasons we did the KDC was to protect information and protect people's private details. And quite frankly, if somebody wants to know, you know, who the grant award winners are and how much the amount they received, they could do an information request for the city. So it's not impossible to obtain that. But we really felt in this small community at this particular time, with all the stress on everybody's lives with COVID and travel restrictions and health concerns and masks, not masks, school, not school, that we just felt it would improve the process if we didn't release people, business owners, in some cases individuals, names and amounts they award. Because we didn't want anybody to be embarrassed or feel somehow that they were made to be feel ashamed because they had to ask for money. Now, some people were, you know, they would ask for the full, they would ask for $300,000. They weren't ashamed at all. But that's the reason why. It's ultimately public money. You know, the public has a right to know that. We recognize that. But we're also trying to temper that with the understanding is that we want to have an opportunity to do second and third round grants. And we don't want to discourage anybody because they're concerned that their name will be on the front page of the paper, similar to, you know, there's inserts that come out every quarterly on people are behind on taxes or something. And it's always like the page of shame, you know, somehow. And we just didn't want, we were sensitive to that. Now, if somebody really wants to know that information, they just have to do an information request for the city, and that information is available.
Well, I mean, the sense I get from you is there's an enormous amount of need, and we can almost assume that 80, 90% of the whole business community and the nonprofit community and the church community is in pretty hard times right now, and they all need local support.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think there are a lot of – thank you, John, for your very politically correct answer. Amy's just like, no. John's right.
And now we'll turn to John for the explanation
John
of that.
John is completely right, 100%. There are a lot of businesses who I know would be very happy to talk about the grants that they got, and so those folks are out there too. When I say no, I know the folks that I'm protecting. As they handed in their applications, like, they were like, who's going to get to see this? And it was a tentative. And then I had businesses and even people in my own membership that I was like, hey, I haven't seen an application. They're like, yeah, we don't want the whole world to know. And so that really clued us in during the application process about how protective people are of their finances. And, you know, we knew that, but I was like, even if you need the money, you're not going to apply. And they're like, no, we'll make it. And so that reinforced that idea of how good it was to have it going through the Economic Development Corporation. So I think that was a good decision.
And as we're talking this through, I mean, we actually could on the grant, not the application, but the request form that they signed saying, I acknowledge receipt of funds. You know, we actually could add a block saying, would you agree to have your name listed on a public document saying name and amount, and they can have a yes, no block, you know, I mean, it still wouldn't prevent somebody from doing an information request, but you know, we certainly could do that. If the public really wants to know, I think, you know, I certainly would consider adding that on there, so that if somebody, a business says, no, I don't care if my name is mentioned in the amount, they can sign a yes, no block.
Yeah. So you're anticipating that maybe the next round's going to be sometime soon.
I think that we will get our funding information from the borough on their July 16th meeting. That's when they're supposed to decide. So then we would know. And then the members of the Kodiak Economic Development Corporation will have to get together on the 17th or 18th and decide what that looks like, and decide how, when, and what the timeline looks like. And then if we're able to raise the cap for businesses that already got $25,000, or we want to change any of the details. So that'll be determined after our funding is determined.
So I want to put in a quick, I think, commentary here, political commentary maybe, is that...
This is public radio, you know.
Yeah, I know. So we'll be back at the borough assembly meeting on the 9th and the 16th. But, you know, the borough hasn't decided how they're going to allocate the funds yet. I think the borough manager is going to create a list, much like the city manager did. So two parts to this. One is, we don't know if the borough is going to allocate money to businesses. We certainly hope they are. We've encouraged them. You know, I went there at the first meeting and said, I'm here to talk about the process. Amy said, I'm here to ask for money. So she's really bold about that. I try to be more discreet, but you know, I'm no longer. We want the money. So
one of you is in politics.
Yeah, yeah. So there's the side that says, okay, are they going to allocate money? Is the borough assembly going to allocate money? And we certainly hope they do and encourage them to do it. And the second part would be, would they use KEDC to do it? Because, you know, we've got a proven process. It's certainly streamlined, but there's no guarantee that the borough wouldn't create their own process. So we certainly would, I mean, as much as we'd like to see the money go into the community, that's the number one priority. Number two would be to allow KEDC to do it, because people have already applied. We wouldn't want them to have to apply again, be confused, because if we have a second round of grants, would they apply from the city and a separate application with the borough? It just makes sense to streamline it, and I'm hoping the borough assembly would see that too.
Okay. Yeah, I think we've built trust with the businesses, and it would make sense to capitalize on that trust. And where do you drop off the application? And like all the, since they're just getting used to this, to change that might be more confusing. Yeah.
And we're not, and I'll really be clear, just I am on the city council, but this is not the KEDC is not a city or a borough entity. We're not city. We're a separate, completely separate entity, who are just taking, in this case, city money and hopefully borrow money to redistribute it. We're a pass-through.
Trends that you saw, I mean, did, without getting into names, you know, was it the full spectrum of the business community? You said you made a lot of grants to the village communities. Are all of, did you see applications from all of the villages?
I didn't see any from Accioch. I saw Larson Bay, Port Lions, Old Harbor, and Carluck. So, it was pretty widespread. Probably most from Port Lions and Old Harbor out of all the villages. But there's also wilderness lodges on Raspberry Island and a Fogneck Island, so there too. So I wanted to make a really big deal that this was an archipelago-wide program. And not just because a lot of people, because the money did come from the city of Kodiak, they thought it was city-based, and that's not what it was. And it wasn't just island-based. We wanted it to go across the whole archipelago. So a lot of the fishing charters and wilderness lodges in the villages, and then the small gift shops and the other things that are in those villages also put in for money that we were able to fund.
And in terms of trends, I think the biggest trend I saw, and Amy, this is actually Amy's bailiwick, is the just the comprehensive impact to tourism industry. And whether it's a B&B, whether it's a car rental agency or fishing charter, air taxi, you know, the fact that those businesses probably won't start up, or if they do, it's going to be an extremely limited startup, tells me that they're not going to generate revenue for the rest of the year for 2020. Their 2020 season is pretty much done. So they have to figure out how to survive to 2021. And that, in terms of trends, I think that is really a very troubling trend, because there's not a lot of opportunities for people, especially remote lodges or the villages, to replace the income they've lost.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think another industry that was obviously extremely hard hit was our bear guides and our bear lodges and stuff like that, who specifically target hunters for the bear season. A lot of them are holding out hope for a fall bear season, but that's yet to be determined. So that's they only have a small few week period to make money in the spring, and that was completely taken away. And then it'll be the same in the fall, and that's yet to be determined with travel. So they're ones to keep eyes on for sure, and they will have continued impact, obviously, that we don't know. I think, as John said, a lot of the tourism-based industry had hope for, you know, maybe we'll have a spectacular August and September, but we just don't know yet. So that those future rounds are really going to be able to help out those kind of businesses who are continuing to see loss that maybe they were still hopeful that we were going to fix throughout the summer.
Right. I got another follow-up on this. The person says they're not looking for applications, just recipients and grant amounts, public funds, public information. Your response was, if you really want it, you're going to have to file a records request to get it.
Yeah, and that's to be being, and I understand the public funds, and because the city processed the checks, that information is subject to records requests. So we're certainly saying you can't have it. Just by all means, do a records request if you actually need that information.
But if you want to keep in the spirit of the program, right?
Yeah, right.
I mean, it's not something that we're going to want to broadcast to people,
right?
Because
we're not printing it in the paper.
Yeah, and
we're not distributing a list. In no way, sorry, caller, that we are saying that you can't have it. That's not the situation at all. But we're not going to broadcast it, and it's certainly not going to be something that you're going to read in the Kodiak Daily Mirror.
So there's two. You're right. There's two ways to get it. If you want that information, by all means, contact the city, and the city will provide you with the information. But if we were to disseminate it, it'd have to be, you know, broadcasted somehow, and we just don't want to do that, just to be respectful to our applicants.
Okay. Before we close today, since we're a little over time anyway, but I want to talk to you about testing at the airport.
Yes, testing at the airport became available yesterday with the afternoon jet. Well, I suppose it's the only jet right now, so the jet. Island Air is working with CANA. There is a tent facility behind the Island Air building. So when you walk out of the airport, you'll see a sign that says testing around the corner, and there's a blue arrow, and you can walk back there. Those folks are there only for a certain amount of time after the jet arrives for testing. The testing facility that's in town is still happening. You just need a referral, and CANA is testing anyone who wants to be tested. So Island Air and CANA first started this to have testing available for people flying out to the villages, but it has evolved into testing for anyone who wants it as they come off the plane. And I don't know if the word is out there yet, but starting July 12th, 3 days a week, we're going to start going back to our normal schedule with Alaska Airlines and have two jets a day. So there'll be an AM and PM jet 3 days a week, and then our, you know, plus the one day a week that we have now, or one jet a week that we have now. One jet a day, sorry. So we're starting to see some increased service. Alaska Airlines still has limited capacity on the way that they're blocking out the middle seats, but they are seeing more requests for coming to Kodiak. So it's very nice to see CANA and Island Air working together, and I know there's a lot of other folks that worked. So thank you to everyone who made that happen. I think they're borrowing a tent from the Coast Guard, and so there's a lot of entities that came together to make that happen. So we're happy to have that option for folks when they get here.
Clarify, though, if the tent is out there originally to provide testing to people going to the villages, the planes go in and out to the villages all day long.
But there'll be set hours that you can go get tested there. And so if you're getting tested before you go to the villages, it's the quick test that they'll take it there. They'll still take it into CANA to get it the answers. So you would be able to go the day before and get tested before you fly or whatever.
I got you. So yeah. Now the thing is, if you're planning on going to the village, you can go out to the airport when the jet's supposed to arrive during that window.
You can.
And get a test.
And you can
that.
Also go to the regular testing that's set up at the elementary school
right.
and get that done. This is just another option that for when people are coming in, mm-hmm. there's been as the governor has set out his mandates and, you know, their the declaration forms, which is now electronic, it's not actually even a paper form anymore. People are getting a QR code. There's a lot of technology that's involved in it. And some folks, that's foreign language to them, that aren't doing that. When you get into the airport in Anchorage, if Anchorage isn't your final destination, you're going to a new gate. There are people kind of slipping through that system because they're not going to a testing or an area as they're leaving because they're staying in the airport and they're coming to Kodiak. So this is just another step that someone can get tested if they want to. It's not mandatory, but the option is there. So if people want to do the right thing, they have
it. It's available.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, tell us about fun things before Fun things.
Absolutely. So fun things. And something that happened last year that's happening this year on schedule with, like, no bad things involved, so COVID-19 is not involved at all on this one, is the Adjust Your Altitude Hiking Challenge launches July 1st. Sign-ups are happening right now at Discover Kodiak. We added a new division this year for more casual hikers. So if people have kids and they want to go hiking, or you don't want to hike to the seven summits on the road system, they're a little intense for a lot of folks. This is an option for people to go out. There are six hikes on it that are just more casual, less intense than the summits.
You have to slow this down a little bit for people who don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, sorry. You know, so Discover Kodiak, this is our second year. We have a hiking challenge. If you come into Discover Kodiak, you get a passport and it has all of the mountain names on it or the hikes on it. And if you go out and show that you were there, you get a challenge sticker. You take a picture of you and the sticker, which changes colors every year to make sure that you have the updated sticker. No using your last year's pictures. And you get out there and you can come in and show us all your passport of when you were at all of the places you're supposed to be, and you show us your picture proof. And then for the main challenge, we have a $1,000 cash prize. We also have a float plane trip from Kingfisher Aviation for three people to go. It's a waterfall tour, which is spectacular. And then for the foothills division, the more casual hiking division, there's a $500 grand prize. And we have just wonderful sponsors this year. They're giving all kinds of weekly prizes. The Kodiak Chamber of Commerce is giving stuff. CrossFit Kodiak is giving stuff. So you can win just a lot of different stuff. So we'll fill you all in on the details. If you want to come down to the office and get signed up, you do have to sign a waiver in order to participate and be eligible for the prizes. So I think it's going to be a great year. Last year, we had about 350 people total sign up for the challenge. In the first 4 days this year, we were at 285. So super excited to see people out on the trails.
Wait a minute, I thought you said July 1st. What is that?
Well, because you're signing up. Your hikes, and you can hike now, but your hikes don't count towards a challenge until July 1st.
So, right. So what we did the last couple of weeks doesn't count.
Just practice.
Just getting ready.
So what's the drill? Then you go up to the top of North Sister and you take your picture up there and put it in your passport book?
So you go up to the top of North Sister, you have a picture of you. There's no actual like geo marker on the top of North Sister, so it's just you and the view. So And some people are going to be up there in the fog, and we understand that, and we'll be lenient. But there's not a lot of people who are trying to cheat on the seven summits. If you come in with seven like white background pictures, then we'll know. But you go up there, you take a picture of yourself, the sticker, and the view from where you're at, or the geomarker if there's one up there, or barometer. We take the crosses or the geomarker, but sometimes the crosses are more fun to take pictures
of. Barometer is one of the seven?
Yes, it is. People
have
campaigned to get that one off, but the answer is no. So the Foothills edition has Heitman just to the lake, so you don't have to go to the summit of Heitman. So the lake is about a third of the way up to the summit. Pyramid just to the shelf, so you go almost to the top of Pyramid, but you don't have to climb that wall at the top. And then the rest are fairly easy. It's termination point on the coastal trail out to where there's a driftwood house and a rope swing. It's pretty easy to follow. And then Near Island, and it's the north end trails to the south end trails. I kind of teach people about the trails that go behind Rotary Park and how you don't have to cross the road till you get to the south end. We actually taped that so people could find their way because it's a little bit of a maze back there. And then we have you can drive to the top of Pillar Mountain Park, and you can hike from the first wind turbine to the sixth and back, and you have to take pictures at both ends showing that you were up there. Oh. So it's just and Spruce Cape. All you have to do is walk out to the tip of Spruce Cape and back. So you can start flat and build your way up, and it's a great thing for kids. Just, you know, a little less intense for those folks who don't want to do the actual summits.
So they come and see you.
They do. Actually, it's my girl Nina at the front desk. She'll hook you up. But we get you all signed up and signed your waiver. And starting July 1st, all of your hikes will count towards that challenge. So we're excited to see that go out this year, just like it did last year. It seems like this is a great thing to do. You can do this even if we're hunkered down for some reason. Get out and hike. It's good for everybody.
Sign me up. Thanks, guys. Really appreciate you coming in.
Oh, thanks for having us, Mike.
Thanks for what you're doing. Thanks, looking forward to seeing what comes up next.
Our pleasure.
Listen to the borough meeting.
That's right.
Yeah. All right, have a nice day.
You've been listening to The Lowdown here on KMXT 100.1 FM and HD. We're also streaming live on the web at kmxt.org.